Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 264. Super fun chat today with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who was so incredibly warm and sweet and had a lot of really great stuff to say, and it was an absolute pleasure to chat with him. It's always so cool to see someone who starts off in the business young and then grows up to be a nice, responsible individual. It seems like a totally normal guy. And then on top of that, to be able to evolve his career into a really serious acting career. When you think about the movies this guy does, he really is in some of the best stuff that the film industry has to offer. And I think he had a really good time on the episode as well, because after the show, it was like, hey man, thanks. And there was a nice hug. There was a nice, warm, like, sincere hug. So, all the ladies and or dudes who enjoy the Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you're gonna melt a little bit. He's sweet and charming and handsome and sensitive, but not in a way where you're like, ugh, get over it. Like a nice guy. Sincerely good dude. Am I gushing too much? By the way, I saw Looper last week. Really fun movie. I love the Bruce Willis, like, kind of... Bruce Willis is his own sci-fi genre now, and Looper was a terrific movie, so go out and see it if you get a chance. This particular episode of the Nerdist Podcast was kindly brought to you by Stamps.com. You can buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. You don't need to do anything, people. You have to do a moderate amount of work. Of going to a computer and then clicking a couple things and then printing out the exact postage. It's like modding your own postage. It's customizing your own postage. You realize the concept of that would have melted our grandparents' brains? They'd be like, what? Are you a billionaire? How do you have the post office print out odd numbered postage stamps? And why are they so expensive now? And then you'd have to figure out how you were talking to your grandparents in the old days. Are you in some sort of time traveler, or are they? Basically, you have a lot of stuff to work out with your grandparents, but it's all exciting. Kind of like Looper. See, I brought it back around unintentionally. But Stamps.com, it packages, letters, whatever you need. You don't have to go to the post office. You can do it right from your own computer. And we have a promo code for Nerdist listeners. There's a no-risk trial, $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale, up to $55 of free postage. Go to Stamps.com. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That is Stamps.com, and enter the promo code Nerdist. Also, if you are in the Nashville area, I will be performing in early December, I think the 6th through the 9th, at Zany's. It's going to happen, people. I'm going back on the road to work out the new hour. The Comedy Central special airs November 10th. It's called Mandroid. And so all that material is burned, which means that new material must take its place. And from the ashes must rise the comedy phoenix. So I'm going to be doing a bunch of shows coming up in the next several months on the road. So come help me work out the new set. But Chris Hardwick, why do we want to see you work out the set? I want to see finished A-list material. I know, but the process is fun. And then I'll probably talk to the audience more to fill time. And you know what happens? That means you could be involved in the show. Huh? Just like at medieval times where dinner is the show. Did I do that right? Episode number 264, The Wonderful Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Nerdist Podcast.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
They're the guys that are like operating the remote controls and stuff to land that thing?
Yeah.
Wow. They're really good at video games?
They're good at video games, but their precision with space robots did not help their bowling any. All right.
How you doing, sir?
Joe. Oh, that's Nick.
Oh, hi. I'm sorry.
Nick's in his own world there.
I'm in my own, you know, I recognize people and I say, oh, okay, I'm doing the Sea Crush show, so.
Nick pulls clips for Ryan. What are you pulling today, Nick?
Right now, working on if the refs settle tonight, you know.
That sounds like sports, Nick. I'm already falling asleep.
Gotta see what happens, but it's coming down.
So okay.
Should I have earphones too?
The headphone jack over there doesn't work.
Okay.
Because no one ever upkeeps this studio.
All right.
And don't own it, so we're like, let's just run it into the ground. We are waiting for essentially for the ceiling to cave in, and then no more podcasts.
All right.
It's awesome to have you on. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you, too.
Anna Kendrick was on last week, and she was like, oh, you have to tell Joe I said hi.
Yeah, she's such adores a sweetheart.
You. Yeah.
I can't wait to see her in the movie.
I know. Well, you guys, there's this really cool sort of like cadre of young actors, and Anna's in that, and you're in that. It's just it's like a nice group of people.
I never heard the word cadre used before.
Sort of like a cluster,
it's a French word, right? Doesn't that mean frame?
Well, we had it in. I know it from my Latin classes.
Okay.
When I went to all boys like.
Wow, so you studied Latin.
I studied Latin, yeah.
Wow.
Why not study a dead language? I was like, maybe it'll help me learn other languages.
And?
Well, I didn't really learn many other languages.
No.
So it's good to know.
Never too late, man.
Yeah, I feel like it's too late.
No, I think you're wrong about that.
What?
It's never too late.
Oh my God, you're right. You've already changed my life on the show, Joseph. Is it Joe, Joseph?
Whatever you like. Jose, Giuseppe.
Giuseppe? Anyway,
Yussel.
Which is very appropriate. Very appropriate today. I saw Looper.
Oh, thanks.
I think one of the most fun things besides just the sci-fi element of the movie is watching your Bruce Willis mannerisms throughout the movie, and just like little things that seem to happen in the background where you kind of do the side mouth like,
hey. Is that what it is?
It's just that, isn't that what you remember from Die Hard?
Yeah, that or Double Indemnity.
John McClane.
Yeah, man, it is a unique challenge in that way. And that's always my favorite thing, acting, is becoming somebody else.
Yeah.
If I see a movie I'm in and anything I do reminds me of me too much, I feel like I messed that part up. Yeah, I always want it to feel like somebody else there. And most of my favorite performances are that, you know, they're from these actors who are chameleons, who, you know, they really disappear and you don't see them on the screen, you see the character that they're playing in the story. And so the premise of Looper having to, you know, this time travel story where I'm playing a younger version of Bruce Willis really posed a unique challenge in that way, that I had to transform myself more than I ever had to before.
Please tell me that you shadowed him all up, and then he would just like open his closet to get a tie, and you're like, hey, like, buddy,
Bruce.
How's it going?
Good morning.
Is that how I sound? Did he do that at all? Is that how I fucking sound?
he did one time. Oh, can we say fuck on this?
Yeah,
show?
You can say whatever you want.
Oh, this changes things. he did one time. He's a very understated guy, and not the kind of guy that'll butter you up or just throw out compliments very often, but he did at one point, you know, just kind of offhandedly say, you sound like me. And I was like, yes! You know, internally, I kept it cool on the outside, man. It was a big victory.
Nothing against Bruce Willis, but young Bruce Willis never had as much hair in his head as you, Joseph.
Well.
But there's even a second in the film where you just kind of look at your hairline and it's a second.
Yeah.
And it just like, it completely sets up, it justifies the entire thing.
That's funny. I think that's probably the one moment in the whole script that I improvised.
Nice.
That wasn't written by Ryan. You know, some movies you improvise quite a lot. Like the movie that I did with Anna, 50-50.
Yeah.
You know, that's their whole style. Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, their whole thing, they're comedy writers. And so they, you know, they write the script, but then they're always like trying new things and like, all right, let's do another take and just try something else, see what happens. And, you know, that's a great style. And but it's different, you know, than Ryan's style. Is he writes these very carefully and extremely well-worded scripts, and they're very economical and very particular and very, you know, stylish in how everything's worded. And so you don't improvise at all, really. But that one moment in the mirror you just brought up, that was one thing that I was like, ha, I came up with that.
And it totally, like I said, it's 1 second of the movie and it just totally, like, then you go, okay,
yeah, right.
I get it. I totally get it. A lot of improv with Nolan on Inception? Like,
let me
try something.
Yeah, not much improv on a Nolan set either.
Do you like that, or do you sort of feel, I mean, I think some people, like some actors, I think, feel I think it's more of a challenge to have to do someone else's words rather than like, oh, well, I can, this is however I feel like doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not to say that you don't bring your own self to it. You still do. You just, it's, I guess it's improv in a different way. You're not improvising the words, but you're still improvising in a, you know, or trying to make it organic with what you actually do, how you feel, how you say a line. I mean, all those little subtleties are really what, you know, make the difference. And so...
Well, I think that's also, it's something that I've never been able to figure out. I am not a great actor, so, but just, it almost, you know, like taking someone else's words, it just feels like, oh, I have to put this suit on, and I don't know how to make this suit fit, because I, as a person, would never say that. So how do you find, you know, like, how do you find the essential quality of that character that justifies in an organic way, you know, what the words are?
Well, first of all, the writing has to be good.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I mean, I don't know what experiences you're talking about, but maybe the writing wasn't so good.
That's why engineer like number two in Terminator 3.
Yeah.
You probably recognized me when you sat down.
Probably. Well, I don't know. How was the writing? Was it well
It was actually all right.
Yeah.
I didn't see that movie. Well, it all made... let me just tell you.
I did see Terminator 3. Sorry, man. I don't remember you.
Spoiler alert. The robots take over the world. Yeah. Sorry.
Wait, Terminator 3 or 4?
Terminator 3. Not Terminator Salvation.
Right, Terminator 3.
Terminator 3.
The last one with Arnold in it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I did see that, but T2 is really the one.
Oh my God! Still holds up.
Yeah, yeah, really. I haven't seen it in a while.
It still holds up. Like even the effects from like 92 or whatever it was, it's still like those. You know, that what do you do? Were you a sci-fi fan when you were growing up?
Yeah, always. I was always a sci-fi fan. My dad is like a Trekkie, and you know, for sure. But I remember seeing T2 when I was young. And I remember that really being the first time that I was exposed to the idea of nuclear holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scaring the shit out of me. and I always think of that as an example. Like, that is something that you should be scared out of, you know.
Right.
And that to me is a great example of a movie that's completely a pop movie, completely entertaining, and yet is kind of doing something positive. Is like putting out there this warning that like, hey, there's nuclear bombs out there, and it's probably something we should do something about as a human race. You know, it's
well,
not okay
also
that we have all these nuclear bombs.
Yeah, but also the other message is don't empower the robots.
Right, and that's actually a really good point. You're right, and there's a bunch of those sci-fi movies that are sort of anti-technology in that way, aren't they?
Well, it is. It's the commentary on humanity. When you really break it down, it's. Hey, Americans, let's not be slobs and lean on convenience too much, because when you relinquish control to the robots for convenience sake, that's when the robots crush your skull.
Right, right. There is a good robot, though. Arnold's a good robot.
Arnold's a good robot in T2, yeah.
So not all the robots are bad.
No. The robots are what you make them.
Right.
And they were able to make one adorable. Oh, when that big guy goes into that molten pit, the thumbs up.
Thumbs up.
Not a dry...
I order you not to go.
Stop it, please. I have to do this. Don't you think when Schwarzenegger left office that should have been how he, like, there should have been a pit right in front of the
that
governor's mansion?
That whole thing was embarrassing. Just, I'm from California.
Just
that,
the
that
head.
Too bad to
just
happen.
The head going down.
Do you think the robots are going to take over the world?
Eventually, yeah. I mean... You know, it's just the lines are becoming blurred. I mean, people are living these, you know, these digital, you know, like we, the whole idea of the Matrix is in a roundabout way starting to happen in the sense that people lead, you know, completely separate lives online. Mm-hmm. And how soon before some sort of a software bug gives those digital avatars some type of consciousness.
Right.
And then they start making decisions. Everything's automated. It's going to happen. We are going to turn into to Cybertron at some point.
But it's just a question of how we let it happen or how we make it happen. Let it happen. How we make it happen. I don't know. I like to be optimistic. I think that could be a really cool thing. That's sort of the... With all the dire circumstances running around these days, if anything's going to keep us from going extinct, it's going to be miraculous technology that sort of, you know, helps us figure it out.
Well, it is that double-edged sword. Like, it's your best friend, but be warned. It's like, you know, Prometheus and the fire, you know, it's like, warned.
Sure. Well, if we keep using it just to make money, then we'll probably kill ourselves.
And that's all. Oh, I was going to say that was awesome. Shit. See, I'm the first one to go, man.
You
might be a robot. You're a robot.
maybe.
Handsome, young looking, good performer. You're not a real person. People like you don't really come out of other people. They are created in laboratories.
All right, you got me.
That's how the robots go. All right, you got us.
Yeah, all right, sorry.
We're going to fucking kill you, but, but you got us.
You got it.
Good one for you. but I always, you know, the people that I meet who were actors as kids, who grow up and end up being okay, I always feel like, yes, you know, like I feel like it can happen. Like you and Neil Harris, like just grow up to seem to be like nice guys. Like sure. what do you attribute your crossing over to?
Well, first of all, thanks. I'm glad you think I'm a nice guy.
So far.
I don't know. My parents are really cool. I think that has probably the most to do with it. And they never taught me to, you know, be going for the fame and fortune. They never made it about the money or status or anything like that. It was always just something, acting was something I always loved to do. And they encouraged me to do things that I love to do.
Yeah,
and they never pressured me into doing it. So I don't know. I guess that's kind of what happened. I think when you start focusing on some of the other accoutrement that can accompany an acting career, that's when you get into trouble.
Accoutrement sounds like a robot word.
What did you say earlier? Cadre?
I said cadre. Oh my God. No, here's the part. Here's the M. Night movie where I find out I'm the robot and everyone else is human. I always wonder where the shift happens, because when you're a kid and you're acting, you're not really thinking about the craft of acting. You're just kind of pretending, I assume. But at a certain point, you really do kind of, I assume, step out of it and then really approach it more as a craft. Or does it feel like that way to you? Or is it just sort of like a natural muscle that's exercised?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I only ever had one acting teacher. I never studied other than with this one guy. And it was when I was quite young. I was like 7, 8, 9, 10 when I was taking classes with him. His name's Kevin McDermott. And he really taught us, like, he didn't treat us like kids. He taught us like actors, and he didn't use, I guess, the words. Like, I never knew who Stanislavski was or any of that stuff. But he taught us, you know, to approach it like a craft, I guess, to, you know, think about what would it. Oh, there's that Muppet guy you were talking about.
There's Kyle. There's Kyle Clark.
Yeah.
Yeah. I said our show PA Kyle Clark looks like a Henson walk around Muppet. He's just sort of like, his hair flops and he's got the big beard and he's like, hello, can I hang out with you? Like,
he just put his face up to the window. That's why, distracting.
That's exactly. Now, see, Kyle would be a great robot plant because no one would suspect it. Because
he's so cuddly.
Yeah. And then you go to hug him and then he fucking, and then crush your spine. And then it's all over.
But anyway, to get back to my original point, I was talking about
you're talking about acting, and you were saying like
yeah. So this teacher, he used to teach us stuff like becoming a character and like, you know, considering your character somebody different from yourself, and what would that person do in that circumstance, and where is that person coming from, and teaching us stuff like backstory and, you know, things like that. So I always really did sort of approach it like an art and a craft, even when I was young. And I hated doing commercials and stuff because I would, even when I was 7, I'm like, that's not acting. and I was right.
But you really have to pretend to like a thing for a pile of money.
They just make us look stupid.
Oh, I gave up on commercial auditions so long ago because there are people who just book, like some people just book commercial after commercial after commercial, and I'd go in and be like, I love Fritos, and they're like, fucking get out.
Hey, get out of here.
Yeah, and it is, come on in, Kyle Clark. Thank you for mashing your face up against the window, Kyle.
Hey, dude, how's it going? Kyle,
Joe, nice to meet you.
How's it going?
Good, I couldn't not shove my face against, it's a plate glass window.
Oh, good, of course.
You know, the court says I can still do my face.
Kyle's on probation for a lot of things.
Let's not commit it to tape. Why do we need to repeat said acts?
Does it make you feel better if you know we're not recording on tape because this isn't 84? all right, Kyle, sit there politely and be nice.
All right.
Okay. This is Joe. This is Kyle.
And you.
We were just bowling together, but Kyle was on our bowling
against
team.
The JPL
against
guys,
the JPL
that's
guys.
Really cool.
It was fun. It was really fun.
Man, they just landed a thing on Mars, right?
Didn't help their bowling skills.
But they do kind of look like the A-team.
Do they?
And that's exactly who you want to have the group of guys who get to Mars.
Are they young? How old are the guys that are doing that?
They're ranging in age. I think Bobek, the Mohawk guy, Bobek is probably, he's got to be like 30, maybe 30, yeah. 31.
And it is kind of like playing a video game, the way that they control it, or what?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a video game with a lot of extra math, but ultimately, yeah. Right. I mean, you know, they are, and a lot of stuff is auto programmed, and then you know other things they can control.
And are there separate guys to operate the controls as opposed to the guys that like design and engineer the things? Are there special pilots that they're just good at skilled like?
They're like 8-year-old kids who are really good on Xbox.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
They just put them down there. It's amazing to me, like, how well kids integrate and interface with technology now. Just even at like 4 years old, you see like tiny little kids just whipping through iPads.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Like they're already way ahead. Mm-hmm. They're already way ahead. But I want to, that was going back to the thing we were talking about before. Do you find, is it hard for you, because I feel like actors have to be naturally sensitive because you have to be empathic in a way because you kind of have to get in other people's headspace. So how do you rinse the residue of like a day or month or 6 months of playing a character that, for instance, might be a bummer? Like, how do you not absorb that into your own personal life and kind of shake it off?
That's a really good question. And the answer is, it's you don't always manage to completely rinse it off. There was 1 year where I played three characters in a row, all of whom were really, and like one of them was a sociopathic killer. One of them had suffered a mild traumatic brain injury, and one of them was a soldier going through PTSD. And I played them right back to back. And by the end of that year, man, I was a mess. I was really fucked up. My emotions were all cracked out. I didn't feel anything very well, honestly. And it was after that year that I started thinking about shit. Like I have to figure out another way to approach this so I don't ruin myself.
Yeah.
I once heard a story. This one driver on a set once told me a story about how he drove Walter Matthau.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I could remember what movie he was talking about, and I don't remember what movie he was talking about. But apparently, he told this story where Walter Matthau had to do this really, really intense scene. And before they started rolling, he was telling this guy a joke. And he was in the middle of telling this driver the joke, and then they said, "All right, Walter, we need you, it's time." And he went and did the scene, like really intense, yelling, screaming, angry, dying, like the scene is so intense that he's so mad that he has a heart attack and dies in the scene. And then he got up and came back to the driver and finished telling the joke. and I remember when the driver told me that story, I was like, fuck, man, I couldn't do that at all. Like, that's just not how I'd be able to do it in any way. If I were doing a really intense scene like that, I'd be fucked all day. And that's how I do it. I wake up knowing that I have to do that scene, and just allow myself no pleasure and don't let my mind go to any nice places, and just, you know, it's a head game. You focus your head into that place. And yeah, at the end of the day, it has taken its toll. And if you do a whole part like that for 3 months, 12-hour days doing that, it does wear on you. And I don't know. I don't have an answer yet. But I do kind of look out for myself more than I used to.
Yeah.
Like when I was in 50/50, I would consciously, because I spent all day telling myself I had cancer, so I proactively went home and like reminded myself that I didn't.
Oh my god!
Because I don't know. I'm maybe a little superstitious about stuff like that. You know?
Sure. So. Like you can will yourself into cancer in a weird way.
You know, I think it's powerful stuff, you know, and there's a lot to it. And I don't think we all understand it. I don't think we understand it all.
Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, there's necessarily like empirical evidence for stuff like this, but I believe in certain kinds of magic and things. I don't believe it like I know how to use it or like I have seen anybody shoot a magic missile out of their finger or anything like that.
Magic missile.
Yeah, but Did you play D&D?
I do play D&D. I was a fifth level wizard. Lawful good.
Lawful good.
Yeah, I tried lawful good for a while because I was boring. Like, oh, I want to be a white hat guy. I know. Everyone wants to be chaotic good. Or you want to be like neutral evil or something.
I think you're bringing gritty realism even to your D&D character.
See, I was just about to say magic is science we haven't figured out yet.
Yeah, that's a good way to put
it. But I much prefer your D&D. It's so funny when you... It's just the nerd brain is just automatically trained, and the second you hear a certain juxtaposition of words, when you hear magic missile, you're like, that's very specific. He must... Would you aim this magic missile at an owl bear, perhaps? Maybe I would.
What armor class would that monster have?
What's your thaco? That's fucking awesome. Well, you've just opened up, man. So here was I was about to go down the acting rabbit hole for a second, but do you still play?
No, it's been years since I've
played. It's hard, right? It's really hard.
I would be down to play. It's sort of like acting D&D.
Yeah, when you have a really good DM and a really good party, it is. The problem for me and the group that I played with is that we all started to get so busy. And a good D&D game is like a band. If one person can't show up, no one can play, really. And so you can, unless, you know, they try to roll side missions or whatever, but it just sort of, you just don't want to be that guy who's like, I'm sorry, I'm the reason we can't all do the thing we want to do today.
Yeah, you're right. It's true. It's different than basketball. One guy doesn't show up, you just...
You throw layups
to someone else, or you know, whatever.
With D&D, you're just rolling a 20-sided die, like miss, miss, hit, miss, hit, hit. Yeah, I love the D&D. It's the perfect... marriage of fantasy and math. Just right, like you have statistics and you have imagination.
Do kids play it anymore?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
I think it's one of those things that continues to exist. Like it's one of those timeless things like buying a guitar. Like, you know, despite whatever's happening, there are kids playing guitar in the garage and there are kids playing D&D in the back of a classroom somewhere.
That's me at 14. That's what I was doing. Playing guitar and playing D&D.
Oh, wow! I love to hear that story. Yeah. You got to play against it. It's fun. I mean, it is a commitment, you know? Like, you can do, like, a day mission and play for, like, a few hours, but you really need, you know, you need, like, a year of just every week.
To really develop your character and whatnot.
And yeah. Meltdown Comics, I work at the theater over there. They have the spot that's catty corner to us is an ongoing D&D group. Wow. And they've been together for years.
Wow.
And it's funny because you'll see them and there are times where they are all emotionally going through stuff that none of us know because they're just having, and you'll just see people walking out torn apart and they're just like, we'll get to this in 2 days, but I got a lot to think about.
If you have a character that you've been playing for like a year and it dies, it is a piece of you has died.
sure. Wow, they must have a really great DM if they're feeling like that.
That whole gang are just amazing to watch. Like, they are dedicated on a level I've never seen a group of D&D. Like, they are hardcore.
Wait, do the people that are listening to this understand at all what we're talking about?
This is the Nerdist Podcast. Not only do they understand what you're talking about, I think I just heard the collective goosh of 1,000 nerd girls squeeing in delight that you just said DM. And you didn't mean direct message.
That's on playback now.
Twitter sort of stole DM.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to send me a dungeon master? Oh, you mean a direct message. But I think it's, you know, for anyone, I think D&D is a perfect game for imagination, and certainly for actors, you know, like what a fun, absolutely. It's all theater of the mind stuff.
Yeah, you create a character. It's really like that. That's what, you know, good acting, that's what it is. You create a character, you come up with where they're from, what their parents were like, what, you know, what their strengths and weaknesses are, you know, and et cetera. And then you act it out. And that really is D&D. I don't know. It's funny. Some people I don't think really know what D&D is. They've seen the board games and the computer games and stuff, and they think it's like a board game or a computer game. And it's hard to explain to somebody that's never seen it done that it really isn't there isn't anything to buy, really. Like, maybe some dice.
I think it's clustered in with like Warhammer and Magic.
Magic the Gathering,
sort of fringes, and it's more abstract than that.
With Magic, you know, you have cards, but with D&D, like you just need graph paper, and then just like a velvet bag. Right. And some dice, you know.
Did you say Funyuns in the middle there?
Nope, and Funyuns too. You need Funyuns,
but your dice do have to be in a velvet bag.
They have to be in a velvet bag. I started using that as an insult to people. Sometimes I go, "Hey, what's up, dice bag?" Started using dice bag as an insult. But it's, you know, sometimes you might have the painted figurines or whatnot.
I never played with the figurines.
They don't really, I mean, it just sort of gives you, you know, if you have a map, it just kind of gives you a somewhat of a visual a representation of what's happening. There's a lot of fun, like, you know, role-playing games like Dragon Age is really fun. It's not just D&D. And when I grew up, there was a little D&D boom when it first got popular. There was also like Boot Hill was the Western one. There was a Future one. Like there were just like role-playing games when... We just basically had, when our video games were squares shooting lines at squares, you know, like we had like RPG type games.
Right.
Imagination was at a premium then.
Yeah.
That was just the top of imagination's time.
We don't have to imagine anything anymore.
Oh, no.
I'm looking at you and I almost can't imagine you. Like, that's how crutched I am on technology.
I'm going to need to see your avatar if I want to know who you really are.
Can we do this while playing Halo, guys? Yeah.
Would that be all right? Can we do a LAN party? Let's do a LAN party podcast. I think, you know, the whole performer mentality, do you find it's that relationships are challenging if, you know, like, because unless someone is another actor, and even then you run the risk of, oh, well, they're having their emotional thing that they're going through with their role. Like it, right. I feel like performers that we're a hard group to date.
That's interesting. Maybe you're right. That's probably about as much as I'm going to say about that.
Can I ask a question? Because you were talking about the intensity and sort of getting into it. Were there actors or artists and stuff? Because there is sort of that proud lineage of the super intense artist. Like, were there guys who were your guys that you sort of looked at and went like, well, they went through the pain and intensity process?
Yeah, like I watched all of Dustin Hoffman's movies when I was younger. And I mean, I just this last year, I got to work with Gary Oldman, who I think is one of the great chameleons, as well as, and Christian Bale, too. And
that little indie film, Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises, yeah. And I mean, like Christian in The Fighter is just like... unrecognizable. He's so good.
What about in The Machinist, where he's like,
well, yeah, that too, yeah.
Where he's essentially the size of like Alison Brie.
Yeah. Then I also got to work with Daniel Day-Lewis last year.
Oh,
He played Abraham Lincoln, and I have a part in Lincoln, and it's uncanny. It's really uncanny watching him do what he does, and I love it. I love watching people transform like that. And I guess it is a certain sacrifice. I mean, I only got to know Daniel a little bit the night that we finished shooting. I was lucky enough to be there on the last night. And prior to that, I had never interacted with Daniel or heard his voice. I had only interacted with the president and called him sir. And I had gotten text messages from Daniel and a couple nice, really, really nice letters. But personally, I'd never met him until that last night. It was the first time I ever saw him in just jeans and a t-shirt, drinking a Guinness, like having a good time, speaking in a British accent. it's really something. But
did you play any jokes on him? Like, did you hand him a $5 bill and go, here, you dropped your ID? Like,
no, I didn't.
No Lincoln pranks?
I didn't do that, actually.
God damn it. I'm curious to hear. Well, I haven't heard his Lincoln voice yet.
It's really something.
That's good.
It's not what you'd expect it to be, because...
Lincoln's voice was high.
Historically... Yes, it's documented that Lincoln had a really high voice, but every time you ever see a cartoon or whatever with Abraham Lincoln, it's always 4 score and 7 years ago.
The opposite.
Made famous by Bill and Ted.
But yeah, that's right. You're right. That's probably who I'm imitating.
So you're saying Lincoln didn't say the amen of the Gettysburg Address, party on, dudes?
In my heart, he did.
But I think there were a lot of things about Lincoln that weren't necessarily the image that we have of him. Like, the beard was only something he had for a short period in his life, and then his voice, like you said, was high, and he was actually apparently kind of gangly and sort of... And so, like all these ideas...
He had a beak.
That was the other thing. Yeah. But I'm so excited to see
It's a great movie, man, and it's actually... It's not a whole biography, so you don't see him without the beard. This movie, Lincoln, that Spielberg directed that's coming out in November, it's just the story of this one... brief interval of time where he's trying to pass the 13th Amendment to the Constitution to end slavery in the context of the Civil War. And you really do see him being a human being with all the flaws and hypocrisies and compromises that he has to make.
Yeah.
People coming at him from all sides, telling him he's a terrible person and that he's doing the wrong thing, and him sort of staying the course and figuring out how to navigate all this shit and get the right thing done.
I mean, when you peel back the layers of the mythos of Lincoln, you really... You know, I think it's important for people to see the humanity of Lincoln more than just the icon that's exactly. Lincoln, because I think people can relate. I mean, like, you might want to strive for the icon. Bless you. Or science.
Thank you. Thanks.
I say science sometimes for things. But but I think when you that he was an anxious guy, a depressed guy, yeah. was in a shitty relationship,
right?
You know, and had to sort of stand alone in this, you know. Team of Rivals is a really great book.
Well, that's what they based. They took a part of Team of Rivals and based the script off that book, the Doris Kearns Goodwin book.
Yeah.
Tony Kushner wrote the screenplay.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
that's
it's
awesome.
It's really, to be honest, you hear that Steven Spielberg is making the Abraham Lincoln movie, and you maybe figure that it's going to be more just beautiful. Patriotic, you know, like what you're saying, the icon of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
But I gotta hand it to Steven. He really, I think, took a smart approach to this movie and made something really specific and intriguing and riveting. It's 2.5 hours long, but it feels like a quick movie. It goes so, it's just so good. I love it. I'm really proud to be in it.
When does the Lincoln movie come out?
It's in November. I forget the date. November 9th, maybe.
Okay.
Had you worked on something that heavily perioded, if that's a word?
Perioded?
Like, because, like, just affecting process of trying to create that same intensity, but having that extra element of, how would my thought process be different based right. on this?
Your grammatical syntax completely just destroyed the what was otherwise a really great question.
Yeah. When I just failed both my English degree and my education degree in one run.
I did a long time ago when I was a little kid. I was in before Dark Shadows was a Tim Burton movie. First, it was a soap opera in the 70s.
Yeah.
Then there was a primetime remake in the 90s mm-hmm. that no one really knew about. And I was in that when I was a little kid. And so we did some perioded parts.
That was very polite of you to say the word back to him to make him think it was okay. But it was not an okay word, Kyle.
But that was, you know, a vampire TV show. This was
the non-vampire Lincoln
yeah,
film.
Yeah, well, right. So yeah, I guess this is the first time I've really done a serious drama that was period, especially in my adult life.
But I would almost argue that The Dark Knight is kind of a period piece in a way. I mean, it's a stylized version of, you know,
Timeless.
I think most people would be jealous if you just got to be Robin, but you get to be Robin, you get to be Cobra Commander, you get to be all these.
You're Lincoln's son in the movie, right?
Robert Lincoln.
Did
his
you
eldest
read
son,
yeah. Assassination Vacation, the Sarah Vowell book?
No, what's
oh,
that?
She did this travelogue where she went across the country looking at all these for all of the presidential assassination locations.
Oh, wow.
And her chapter
depressing.
On it's, but it's. Have you ever read Sarah Vowell before?
No.
She's a This American Life person. She's a
I love This American Life.
She's a kooky historian.
Uh-huh.
She's really great. But like the section on Lincoln, and then because Lincoln's son went on to work with McKinley,
uh-huh,
and came into the McKinley administration as McKinley got shot, and so
right,
he
that's right,
carried
that's
through.
Right.
And it's really interesting because she uses Lincoln's son as the through line through a lot of these assassinations and his sort of emotional breakdown.
Oh wow!
But okay, in a really kooky. Public radio kind of way.
It's like called it's Assassination Vacation.
Is the book perioded at all? Or is it...
Is it contemporary?
Yeah, it's contemporary.
Check and mate, Kyle Clark. Point
well
11.
Looper's sort of a period movie too.
Looper is kind of a period movie because it's essentially the current timeline is what, like 2044
that's
or something.
Right.
Yeah. But really fun movie. I do love the kind of Bruce Willis idea of like he, you know, like every few years he picks just kind of a cool sci-fi thing.
Yeah.
And goes with it.
He loved this script, man. I mean, he didn't have to do this movie at all. It's not the kind of movie that can pay him big bucks. Like, he just loved it. It was so apparent, his enthusiasm, from the very beginning. And he showed up to work every day and just killed it. He's really, really good in the movie, too.
Yeah. What's it? That opens this weekend.
This weekend,
yeah.
Can I ask you a really stupid question that I thought of earlier?
Sure.
When you were saying in 50-50 that every day you had to go home and say, I don't have cancer,
yeah.
On loop, or did you have to go home and say, I'm not going to become Bruce Willis?
No, man. Are you kidding? I should be so lucky.
You want to become Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis is one of those guys that makes you feel like it's okay to get older.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
When you go,
oh. He could still kick my ass, and he's 57, and you know, I could probably kick most 57-year-old ass,
but not Bruce
not
Willis
Bruce at all. No.
Yeah, he definitely is one of.
He doesn't seem to age. Like, it just seems to sort of stay.
You know why? I think part of it is because he's been, we've kind of known him as bald Bruce Willis for so long, and so much of how we perceive age has to do with, it's not like he had hair until he was 55 and then it fell out and we're like, oh, look, he looks old. I mean, like, he's always kind of had a shaved head, or you always kind of knew, and he's maintained his general face shape. Mm-hmm. I think that's how he's transcended time.
Good analysis.
He's a fucking robot.
Or he's a robot.
Bruce Willis should be a robot. What was the surrogates?
Oh, I didn't see Surrogates.
Surrogates was a fun movie.
Yeah,
another really fun movie. What else do you want to? I mean, do you want to go do more comedy stuff, or is it just, are you in a period where you're getting more, you're more drawn to take on dramatic roles?
Oh, I'd love to do comedy. In fact, I just the movie I just finished shooting is one I wrote and directed.
What?
And yeah, man, yes.
Congratulations!
Thanks so much. Thanks. It's called Don John's Addiction. And it's a comedy. It's a very dark comedy, but it's a comedy for sure.
Did you have to direct yourself?
Yeah. I wrote I play John, who's a sort of contemporary Don Juan guy, and I also wrote a part for Scarlett Johansson, and she liked it and did the movie, and she's great in it, and Julianne Moore is also in it, and she's fantastic. And Tony Danza plays my dad.
Oh, thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
Because it's not often you're like, Joseph Gordon. If you're in a fucking movie theater, you say, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Scarlett Johansson, Tony Danza. And it gets the next one, you're like, could you back up that last one? Did that say Tony Danza?
He's great in it. He's really good in the movie. Actually, he's such a sweet guy, Tony is.
This is going to sound creepy. Two of the times that I did Kimmel, Tony Danza was coincidentally on both times.
That's funny.
So I've shaken his hand twice, and I reconfirm this the second time. Softest hands in Hollywood.
Interesting. I'm trying to think back. I don't know if I noticed that exactly, but I wouldn't put it past him. he's well-groomed, that's for sure.
He's very well-groomed. He's a dapper gentleman. Did you know him before?
Well, yeah, man. He's an Angels in the Outfield.
Oh, yes, of course.
So this is like our 20-year, literally 20, well, 19-year reunion, because I was 12 when we shot Angels in the Outfield, and I was 31 directing him as my dad.
Oh, my God.
Don John's Addiction. Yeah, it was momentous.
How was the experience for you? Like, is it, you know, because at a certain point, once you work with guys like Nolan and, you know, you do these big films and you come out of it okay and everyone says, great job, and you feel like you did a good job, you have a certain amount of confidence when you walk onto a set as a performer. So what were you able to translate that? Because a director needs to know what he's talking about. Were you able to absorb that confidence for that?
I think so. I hope so. I think it went well. But it's interesting you say that, because the other thing a really good director does, and Nolan does this, Ryan, who made Looper, does this, and Steven does it too. No matter how confident you are and how thorough a preconceived vision you have for it, you have to be flexible and you have to be open to spontaneity and collaboration, and those guys are. So that's really, to me, the crux of a director, is that decision of, okay, am I going to stick with what I thought it should be, or am I going to cut bait and go with the new idea? And that decision, you have to make 100 of those decisions all day long.
Yeah.
And how you make those decisions, I think, is kind of right at the heart of what a good director is.
Is there a science? Because, you know, you're able to pick good movies with good directors that turn out well, and it's very hard to make a good movie for a lot of different reasons. So is there a science behind that, or do you just have sort of a gut thing where you go, I just feel like this is going to be a thing, or do you actually have a formula?
No, there's definitely not a science to it, I don't think. I mean, there's certain things you can look for, but there's counterexamples all along the way. So no, I think it is something kind of more implacable that, you know, that's, I guess, the difference between art and science in a certain way, or magic, that like you can't quite explain it, but it, you know, it works.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is there a character that you just sort of stuck in the back of your head where you're like, someday I want this guy? I mean, whether it's someone who exists or like just a type of a character, is there any sort of, is there any sort of like acting muscle that you feel like you just need to tense?
Well, I want to do a musical one day. I haven't found the right one yet. But one day I'd love to do that. I love singing and dancing.
Do you, do you get karaoke? You karaoke guy?
Sure, man. Sure.
Really?
Well, yeah.
That's awesome.
Why not?
I think I just wonder, because sometimes when people get, you know, sometimes when people get really successful or really famous, they just get super withdrawn. They're like, I can't, I have to, then people are going to, you know, like, right. It's like, how do you, I guess you've been doing it for so long that this is just like, it doesn't really matter.
Also, when you're as good as I am at karaoke, then you don't worry about it.
Oh, shit.
Right.
Somebody just dropped his karaoke dick on the table. What's your song? What's your song?
You'll have to wait. You'll have to wait and see.
Damn it.
Let's turn down. You know, Chris is he does not mess around with his karaoke.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, no. Kyle, please. False modesty.
You need to bring your assistant in here to say that for you? Is that
no, this was a total happenstance that we stumbled upon the karaoke, which I happen to be good at. Which, Kyle...
I'm just saying, he throws down a whole lot of love. And
wow. Really? Led Zeppelin.
Little Zeppelin. You know what, though? Can I tell you that podcasting has ruined karaoke for me? Because I do so much talking in a week between podcasting and stand-up that I just lose, you know, like if I'm doing stand-up, I'm talking for an hour and 15 minutes on stage. Oh, with podcasts, sure. I'm talking for an hour. And you just can't do that and then go, like, screech.
I didn't realize how much, like, singing tears apart your throat, because I hadn't sung in so long. And recently I was at something and I sang with somebody. And just was tore up.
But
the
what
next
did you
day.
Sing? Like Nirvana?
I mean, no, it depends on what you sing. Some punky rock.
That'll
out,
tear up.
Yelling
throat,
and screaming.
Yeah.
The punk goes great.
It's so fun. But,
yeah,
but
right.
The next thing,
you're
like, right. Oh, I forgot. All I need to do in life is talk.
It was knowing Kyle was probably Black Flag.
Yeah.
But
it was something along those lines.
Your throat is a muscle. So it's essentially the same as if you picked up a weight off the ground and then just started doing curls as fast as you could 100 times. And you'd be like, I can't move my arm. That's what you're
true.
Doing to your throat. I think we have to find you a karaoke movie. I feel like the nerd audience will find you a D&D musical. Oh my God. It's called Chaotic Good.
It's Labyrinth, isn't it?
It's Labyrinth. Oh,
I
fucking
feel like
Labyrinth.
We're due for a remake or a sequel on Labyrinth.
We could do a sequel.
I think we got Jareth's son.
Oh my gosh.
Uh-huh.
Well, we work with the, like, God, our YouTube channel. We're partners with the Henson Company, so we have access to all of that.
We can make this happen.
Wow, man.
We could make a musical Labyrinth video with you as doing your best Bowie
that
character.
That sounds good, actually. I'm to practice with one of those glass balls.
With the glass balls. Yeah, Michael Motion. That was the famous juggler. Michael Motion did the ball routine. Good. Well, as long as you don't mind, we're making some very interesting plans for your career. Your agent's probably going to have a lot of questions, but let's just all go with it.
All right.
Okay. Did you do musicals in high school?
I was in musicals when I was much younger than that. Like community theater when I was like as early as I think 5, 6, 7, 8. I was like in little kid, you know, productions of Wizard of Oz and Guys and Dolls and Peter Pan. And
wherever
that
kid was just, you know, flipping kids off and getting that lead in Oliver.
Because
that is the coveted kid role when you're in community theater.
No,
I played Oliver
but
in sixth
Arkham
grade.
The Arkham Dodger is a better part.
Oh, he great. Is a better part. Yeah. Oliver's one note. I played Oliver in junior high. What a fucking snore. The Artful Dodger got fingerless gloves. He got to be dirty. He got the Artful Dodger was chaotic good.
Is he good?
He is good. He
I'll call him chaotic neutral.
You think so?
Yeah, sure.
I think he starts as neutral, but then he arcs to good throughout the course.
All right, I'll
of,
admit, I don't remember the whole story of Oliver as well as you do.
Well, he it's not like I watch it all the time. but Oliver Twist never changes throughout the entire fucking story. He's
Waffle
just
good.
this toe-headed, like...
Scamp.
Scamp that everything just happens around... And the world has to adjust itself for him. Like, he doesn't really do anything. The Artful Dodger is a much better character.
Yeah.
Jack Wilde in the film, super cool kid.
True.
That's a wow, why did I just admit that I played Oliver?
You're screwed now.
I was. I had a total fail when I played Oliver 2 the opening night of the show, because I'm sure everyone's interested. There was a soda machine, and I had gotten change from my mom, and I didn't have time to go get the soda, so I had change in my pocket. And there's this one scene where Bill Sykes yanks up Oliver out of this box, and all this change flew out of my pockets during the performance, which was bad for the character because he's supposed to be a penniless orphan. Yeah. And then all this change spills out.
He's holding out on us.
I think there is something for you in the D&D world that I would like to see happen. Or if you just want to play D&D sometime, we should a bunch of us just get together for a day. I know some comedians.
They should do like a D&D podcast. That'd be.
I'm sure there are several.
Listen to people play D&D?
You have to listen to good people playing D&D.
Yeah, they'd have to be really good or else it'd be boring as hell.
Because when you get spoiled by a good DM who really understands how to present things in a very theatrical way, in a very cinematic way, it was a good story. You need a good storyteller for a DM, not just someone who's good with rules.
Right.
And if you have that and then you go to someone who's really dry, then D&D sucks. So it all hinges on the DM and the group.
Agree.
I do want to mention one thing, and I hope I'll totally cut this out if you don't want me to talk about this or mention this, but I have some friends who are big in the Burning Man community.
Oh yeah.
And when we're huge fans of your brother and said Dan was they loved him and said that he did amazing things for the community, and it's a real nice group.
That's really right. And certainly don't cut this out at all, man. I'm delighted to talk about him in that way. It's true. I went to Burning Man. I didn't get to go to Burning Man this year, but I went last year, and people were just coming up to me constantly and being like, "Your brother changed my life. Just wanted to tell you."
Yeah,
like all the time, and it's really true. He's a very special guy.
I think outsiders kind of look at Burning Man and they go, "What is this? Go to the desert with a bunch of hippies?" And you're like, "But when you realize what it is, it's like this kind of tight knit group of." People who really support each other,
yeah,
and it's really kind of a beautiful. I had to get all mushy, but it's kind of a beautiful thing. It's like people come together in an environment that humans should not be in the desert.
That's right. There's no life there, and there's not even bugs can't even survive.
And they bring life to it. They support each other, and with creativity and
there's no money. Everyone's just like loving on each other and bringing art and making art and supporting each other and encouraging everybody to become the best version of themselves that they can be.
Yeah.
And it absolutely changed his life. I mean, I remember when he first went, and he came back just so different. And I went the next year because he was so excited about it. And it really is. It's kind of, I don't know. I went 2 years ago just briefly, but I don't know. Everyone said it was different this year. And I don't know if that's true or not, but it's kind of the most beautiful party I've ever seen. It's just because it's all art. There's no profit. I mean, I guess someone's turning a profit somewhere, but hardly. I don't think.
Well, there's no pretense. I mean, like there's no. It's not like Burning Man brought to you by Snapple or whatever. You know, it's.
No, it's true. Everyone's just, it's all about finding the most awesome part of yourself and bringing it out.
Yeah.
And that's where he became Burning Dan.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was shy when he was younger. Always like super smart and really funny, but sort of introverted. And Burning Man was really the turning point. I mean, amongst plenty of other things, of course, but, where I just watched him evolve as a person so much and become this really extroverted and lovable dude. Like anybody who met him, the positivity would just radiate out of him.
Yeah.
And I do credit Burning Man in a lot of ways for that.
No one has ever called this phone.
There he is.
Oh my god, I should have answered it.
It's all right.
That would have been so amazing. Like, why'd they hang up on me? I got one call. What the fuck? I'm so sorry.
I appreciate you bringing him up like that.
No, I think it's nice, and you clearly have a lot of love for your brother, and you know, and I'm sorry that you lost him, and you know, but I do think, you know, I think it's heartening in a way that where a lot of people may not, you have this community that kind of keeps him alive, and I you know, I know that he's, you know, probably legendary in that community, and that he'll always be a part of it.
It's true, man. Yeah, he's Burning Dan.
Have you ever thought maybe some type of documentary or some kind of anything about?
Yeah, I think about that all the time. I have all of his hard drives, and you know, we started this thing, or he helped me kind of start this thing, or we started it together, whatever you say, called Hit Record.
Yeah,
which is a great thing.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank
really
you.
Cool.
Thank you.
Well, a lot of the profit goes back to the artist.
That's right. Yeah. And well, it's become this kind of collaborative production company now, where everybody can log on and contribute to these projects that we do, and then when we make money, we split the profits and send checks out to contributing artists. But before it was that, and that's only like 2 years old that it became this professional production company thing. But for a number of years before that, it was just this kind of thing that my brother and I would say to each other, and it represented just kind of being creative. The record button became this kind of symbol for doing that. And he took it really seriously. He hit record like all the time. He has like just, I have this huge container of full of hard drives of photos. He took tons of photos, and he also recorded a lot of audio of just like conversations that he had. And for sure, I do consider it sort of a project I'll be working on for the rest of my life, kind of framing that stuff and turning it into art. And you know, it's difficult, to be honest, at this point to work on it. And I know that it'll get more doable over time.
Sure.
But absolutely. Like, and he's always in a lot of Hit Record stuff, you know, like, if for no other reason than just his spirit is there. Like, we actually sent this last Burning Man. Well, the Burning Man where I went, which wasn't this most recent one, but the one before, we sent the first, I brought the first copy of our first anthology, Recollection, up there and put it in the temple for it to burn up, you know? And this last year we put the first pressing of this, we just made this vinyl record of music. It's the best music we've ever made. It's called Move On the Sun. And, I couldn't go, but I sent my friend Jeff Peff with the first copy of the vinyl to go put it in the temple and burn up, you know, at Burning Man for him. And he's very much still, you know, in it and there, and everyone on the site, if you're sort of in the community, knows who he is and is aware, like, of his spirit. He was so encouraging and so positive, and that's still, I think, part of what happens at Hit Record. People feel welcome and people feel unafraid to try things and you know, put their art out there. And that's very Dan. Like, he's always the one who was like bringing that kind of positivity to it. And so we keep that going.
And so what is, you know, when, and maybe you haven't even figured this out yet, but you know, if there's one thing that you want people to take away from Dan's life and kind of implement into their own lives, what do you think that would be?
That's a good question. Well, like, one way to answer that would be to mention his favorite book ever was Green Eggs and Ham.
Okay.
And the lesson in that, but it's a truly brilliant work of art. I don't know when the last time you picked up a copy of Green Eggs and Ham was, but it's so brief and so eloquent and so fun. And the message in it is like so healthy that you got to try things. Mm-hmm. Even if it looks weird, if you try it, you really might like it, you know? And that's him. And that's him at Burning Man too. And he tells a story about when he started spinning fire. He eventually became, I would argue, the best fire spinner that I've ever seen. I guess I'm biased, but ask a lot of people. He really was like a special artist when it came to spinning fire. And he tells a story about how he never used to think that he was the kind of guy that could do that. Because he was the kind of guy that would maybe just, you know, dress modestly. And, you know, he worked on computers and stuff and, you know, has sort of a quiet voice and wasn't the kind of guy that could light something on fire and spin it around and make everybody around all look at him. But at Burning Man, he decided to do it. And he got so good at it, you know, and it became this, he became Burning Dan. He started a school, Flow Temple, you know, that still exists. And like, that's the people who tend to come up to me at Burning Man and say, your brother changed my life. It's usually fire spinners. It's usually people who he taught Flow to, Poi, yeah. Spinning Poi. You know, you have to, the hardest step though is sort of just trying it, you know. At the very beginning, you're like, I can't really do that. Just give it a try, you know? Like, I'm not going to like that. Those eggs and ham are green, you know? But, like, you know, at some point, you have to kind of trust Sam I Am and let it happen.
Well, and I think most people, and I think what we always try to tell people on this podcast is you have to do it. You have to try stuff. No one, when they start out, really has any more information than you have. The only difference is they just tried the thing,
right?
And you're gonna fall down,
right?
And it's gonna suck for a while,
that's right.
But you will get better and you will appreciate the process, and then before you know it, then some kids come up and go, how do I start doing that? And yeah, you go, you just fucking start.
Yeah, you just have to try it. Yeah. Well, that's so him, man. And that is also hit record. Like, that's the idea that the hardest part is pushing the button to like actually get started, and
right.
Then you're recording, and then, you know, then you can go from there, and you can go back and edit it, and you don't have to put it out there, and you can like, you can hit record again and try something new, and like, you don't have to, it's not the end of the world, you know, and nothing really bad is going to happen.
It doesn't have to be perfect when you start.
That's right. It really doesn't.
And sometimes the imperfections, the accidental imperfections, a lot of times actually are what give things their personality, become their best
okay,
things.
Absolutely. That's right.
You know, like when Kyle put his face against the window. No, actually, that was the worst part of this part. That was the worst part. But also, just that, you know, I like to kind of have this idea that once you start, even you don't have all the answers up front. You don't need to have all the answers up front. But as you start down a path, answers really do reveal themselves to you, but you just have to be walking down that path.
You have to do it, yeah. There's a difference between knowing the path and walking the path.
Like writing and directing your own movie.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's for sure scary. And like, I don't know, there's no way to prove that I can do it. I thought I could do it, and I was lucky to have a lot of encouraging people telling me, you know, to go for it, and I did.
I think for anyone listening to the podcast, you might be like, you know, listen to these performers. I don't know who this character is. Listen to these performers talk. I work in a copper mine, and that's hard work and acting. And it's like, all I want to say to people is just try it. Try wildly fluctuating your emotions and holding them in some sort of a weird foreign stasis for 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours a day for months. And then just see if it's the easiest. I mean, you know, like, we are emotional creatures, and fucking with those knobs is a weird, you know, kind of a scary thing to do.
Did you notice this with directing, that to me the thing that always freaks me out with it is that everybody's like, so you have to make this decision, we're all waiting and money's right. going, and you just feel like you're trying to stop the sandbag that's spilling sand, and to get comfortable with that is one of the most terrifying feelings.
Yeah, that's you're absolutely right. That is being a director. Yeah. You have to be the one to decide. And, you know, it's also true that sometimes you can do it both ways and decide later. And I think that's actually sort of the bane of movie making nowadays, is because so much happens in post-production.
Yeah.
They're like, we'll just cover it. We'll cover it both ways, and we'll see what happens later. And you can tell when you watch a movie that's really made in post-production.
Did you mean it was the bane of your existence? Oh, young Robin, come over here and give Bane a hug. He has presents for you.
Did you get to the last page of that Batman script and go, oh,
holy shit! What the fuck? Is this a fucking joke?
Like, did you have the same reaction as the rest of them? Like, oh,
yeah. No, I did.
Sure.
Yeah, for sure. I totally did. And I was like, not to brag, I was one of like four people that actually had the last page of the script. No one else had it. Christian had it, and I had it, and obviously Chris and Emma had it, and I think Wally knew. No one knew. We were totally just keeping it a secret, even from people that were working.
Yeah, because you shoot that scene by yourself.
Yeah.
So no one else really has to know until the end of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, everyone in the crew got to see it.
You must have a Bane impression. Everyone's got to have a Bane impression by now.
Certainly not.
Well, we're about at an hour, but it's really been cool talking
to you.
Man,
what a pleasure. You know, I've been doing interviews now for way too long.
Sure.
Because I happen to have like all these movies coming out at once, and it... interviews are usually pretty boring, to be honest. It's so refreshing to get to actually have
a conversation. Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's good to see you. And Kyle, thank you for...
Yeah, man.
Matt and Jonah, we normally have two other co-hosts on the show. They are on a plane to Toronto because we're performing in Toronto tomorrow night. They unfortunately could not be here. But again, thanks for coming on. And great. Yeah, good luck with Looper.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed the movie. And enjoy your green eggs and ham burrito, everyone.
Thanks again.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.